And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, so dogs are really smart, loyal, and friendly, unless they're angry. And cows are, well, somewhat docile and fall in line. Otters are just the opposite. They are up for anything new and seem to have an endless need for fun and frolic. While a koala bear, I can't think I've ever seen one giggle. All of the wonderful creatures on this earth have personalities, and even within a family, there are differences. Today, we look at one of the smart common bird species which just loves being with humans. You've got a lot to crow about when your voice of the earth continues. Here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Welcome to the Wild Side News. Boy, it's hot. I'm in San Diego, and we're setting records. When we get this kind of heat, we start to wonder. You've all heard about the fires that we've had. I was sitting here in my studio today, and I started smelling some smoke, and all of a sudden I said, oh my gosh. I got onto my computer and looked at Google to see if there was some sort of news story about some new fire breaking out in the East County. But alas, that isn't the case, but fires have become an enormous part of our world. And in an upcoming show, we're going to take a look at the increase in fires and what this may mean. There's been an incredible increase in the total number of acreage that's been burned. But so far, so good here in San Diego. I personally have had a few close calls with these fires. Today is a show about crows. I love crows. It's easy to overlook these creatures. When you go outside, very often you'll be hearing crows in the distance. You'll see them crowing from on top of a tree. And they're very likely letting everybody know that you're there, whether you know it or not. They're telling people, up, he's back. And there's some amazing stories about crows. They're extremely intelligent animals. They're curious. And I suppose the one factor about them that is so unique is the fact that they love to figure things out, unlike a lot of other animals that really just don't have that curiosity. You give crows a problem, and that becomes their fixation. Well, today we're going to hear a guy who spent some time really studying about crows. He's very entertaining, Joshua Klein. And he's going to be here during our weekly Earth Summit, which, of course, is coming up in the first segment of the show, as it does each week here on the Wild Side News. And then in segment two, there's so much news happening these days. I'm going to take a broad spectrum look at some of the stories that catch my attention these days in the news, and to kind of broaden that out a little bit, because there's just such a diversity of amazing things happening. So in segment two, we'll be focusing on that to try to get you caught up a bit. And then I'm going to indulge myself and hopefully entertain you a bit with a piece that I wrote a number of years back that follows on the theme of the crow. And it's actually called The Squirrels, but it deals with a moment. There are so many amazing moments in this world of animals and humans, and this was one very important moment for me. I'll be reading The Squirrels to close out the show. On this very hot day, coming from San Diego but reaching out around the world, we now hear the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit. The most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we take a really interesting look at crows with a man of many talents, one of these kind of wizard guys who just sticks his nose into everything and then finds out some amazing stuff and has a unique capacity to share that. So I want to welcome to this week's Weekly Earth Summit, Joshua Klein. Joshua?
How many of you have seen the Alfred Hitchcock film, The Birds? Yeah? Any of you get really freaked out by that? You might want to leave now. So this is a vending machine for crows, and over the past few days, many of you have been asking me, how did you come to this? How did you get started doing this? And it started as with many great ideas, or many ideas you can't get rid of anyway, at a cocktail party. About 10 years ago, I was at a cocktail party with a friend of mine, and we were sitting there, and he was complaining about the crows that he had seen that were all over his yard and making a big mess. And he was telling me that really we ought to try and eradicate these things. We got to kill them because they're making a mess. And I said that was stupid. You know, maybe we should just train them to do something useful. And he said that was impossible. And I'm sure I'm in good company in finding that tremendously annoying when someone tells you it's impossible. So I spent the next 10 years reading about crows in my spare time. And after 10 years of this, my wife eventually said, look, you know, you've got to do this thing you've been talking about and build the vending machine. So I did. But part of the reason that I found this interesting is that I started noticing that we're very aware of all the species that are going extinct on the planet as a result of human habitation expansion. And no one seems to be paying attention to all the species that are actually living, that are surviving. And I'm talking specifically about synanthropic species, which are species that have adapted specifically for human ecology, species like rats and cockroaches and crows. And as I started looking at them, I was finding that they had hyper-adapted. They become extremely adept at living with us. And in return, we just tried to kill them all the time. And in doing so, we were breeding them for parasitism. We were giving them all sorts of reasons to adapt new ways. So, for example, rats are incredibly responsive breeders, and cockroaches, as anyone who's tried to get rid of them knows, have become really immune to the poisons that we're using. So I thought, let's build something that's mutually beneficial. Well, let's build something that we can both benefit from and find some way to make a new relationship with these species. And so I built the vending machine. But the story of the vending machine is a little more interesting if you know more about crows. It turns out that crows aren't just surviving with human beings. They're actually really thriving. They're found everywhere on the planet except for the Arctic and the southern tip of South America. And in all that area, they're only rarely found breeding more than 5 kilometers away from human beings. So we may not think about them, but they're always around. And not surprisingly, given the human population growth, more than half of the human population is living in cities now, and out of those, 9/10 of the human growth population is occurring in cities, we're seeing a population boom with crows. So bird counts are indicating that we might be seeing up to exponential growth in their numbers. So that's no great surprise. But what was really interesting to me was to find out that the birds were adapting in a pretty unusual way. And I'll give you an example of that. So this is Betty. She's a New Caledonian crow. And these crows use sticks in the wild to get insects and whatnot out of pieces of wood. Here she's trying to get a piece of meat out of a tube. But the researchers had a problem. They messed up and left just a stick of wire in there. And she hadn't had the opportunity to do this before. You see, it wasn't working very well. So she adapted. Now this is completely unprompted. She had never seen this done before. No one taught her to bend this into a hook. No one had shown her how it could happen. But she did it all on her own. So keep in mind that she's never seen this done. Right. Yeah. All right. So that's the part where the researchers freak out. So it turns out we've been finding more and more that crows are really, really intelligent. Their brains are proportionate in the same proportion as chimpanzee brains are. There's all kinds of anecdotes for different kinds of intelligence they have. For example, in Sweden, crows will wait for fishermen to drop lines through holes in the ice. And when the fishermen move off, the crows fly down, reel up the lines, and eat the fish or the bait. It's pretty annoying for the fishermen. On an entirely different tack, at University of Washington, they a few years ago were doing an experiment where they captured some crows on campus. Some students went out, netted some crows, brought them in, and weighed them and measured them and whatnot, and then let them back out again. And were entertained to discover that for the rest of the week, these crows, whenever these particular students walked around campus, these crows would caw at them and run around and make their life kind of miserable. They were significantly less entertained when this went on for the next week and the next month and after summer break, until they finally graduated and left campus, and glad to get away, I'm sure, came back sometime later and found the crows still remembered them. So, the moral being, don't piss off crows. So, now, students at the University of Washington that are studying these crows do so with a giant wig and a big mask. It's fairly interesting. So we know that these crows are really smart, but the more I dug into this, the more I found that they actually have an even more significant adaptation.
crows have become highly skilled at making a living in these new urban environments. In this Japanese city, they have devised a way of eating a food that normally they can't manage. Drop it among the traffic. The problem now is connecting the bits without getting run over. Wait for the lights to stop the traffic. Then collect your cracked nut in safety.
Yeah, pretty interesting. So what's significant about this isn't that crows are using cars to crack nuts. In fact, that's old hat for crows. This happened about 10 years ago in a place called Sendai City at a driving school in the suburbs of Tokyo. And since that time, all the crows in the neighborhood are picking up this behavior. And now every crow within 5 kilometers is standing by a sidewalk waiting to collect its lunch. So they're learning from each other, and research bears this out. Parents seem to be teaching their young. They learn from their peers, they learn from their enemies. If I have a little extra time, I'll tell you about a case of crow infidelity that illustrates that nicely. The point being that they've developed cultural adaptation, and as we heard yesterday, that's the Pandora's box that's getting human beings in trouble, and we're starting to see it with them. They're able to very quickly and very flexibly adapt to new challenges and new resources in their environment, which is really useful if you live in a city. So we know that there's lots of crows. We found out they're really smart, and we found out that they can teach each other. And when all this came clear to me, I realized the only obvious thing to do is build a vending machine. So that's what we did. This is a vending machine for crows, and it uses Skinnerian training to shape their behavior over 4 stages. It's pretty simple. Basically, what happens is that we put this out in a field or someplace where there's lots of crows, and we put coins and peanuts all around the base of the machine, and crows eventually come by and eat the peanuts and get used to the machine being there. And eventually, they eat up all the peanuts, and then they see that there are peanuts here on the feeder tray, and they hop up and help themselves. Then they leave, and the machine spits up more coins and peanuts, and life is really dandy if you're a crow. Then you can come back anytime and get yourself a peanut. So when they get really used to that, we move on to the crows coming back. Now they're used to the sound of the machine, and they keep coming back and digging out these peanuts from amongst the pile of coins that's there. And when they get really happy about this, we go ahead and stymie them, and we move to the 3rd stage, where we only give them a coin. Now, like most of us who have gotten used to a good thing, this really pisses them off. So they do what they do in nature when they're looking for something. They sweep things out of the way with their beak, and they do that here, and that knocks the coins down the slot. And when that happens, they get a peanut. And so this goes on for some time. The crows learn that all I have to do is show up, wait for the coin to come out, put the coin in the slot, and then they get their peanut. And when they're really good and comfortable with that, we move to the final stage, in which they show up and nothing happens. And this is where we see the difference between crows and other animals. Squirrels, for example, would show up, look for the peanut, go away. Come back, look for the peanut, go away. They do this maybe 6 times before they get bored, and then they go off and play in traffic. Crows, on the other hand, show up and they try and figure it out. They know that this machine's been messing with them through 3 different stages of behavior. They figure it's got to have more to it. So they poke at it and peck at it and whatnot, and eventually some crow gets the bright idea that, hey, you know, there's lots of coins lying around from the 1st stage, lying around on the ground, hops down, picks it up, drops it in the slot, and then we're off to the races. That crow enjoys a temporary monopoly on peanuts until his friends figure out how to do it, and then there we go. So what's significant about this to me isn't that we can train crows to pick up peanuts. Mind you, there's $216 million worth of change lost every year, but I'm not sure I can depend on that ROI from crows. Instead, I think we should look a little bit larger. I think that crows can be trained to do other things. For example, why not train them to pick up garbage after stadium events, or find expensive components from discarded electronics, or maybe do search and rescue? The main point of all this for me is that we can find mutually beneficial systems for these species. We can find ways to interact with these other species that doesn't involve exterminating them, but involves finding an equilibrium with them that's a useful balance. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joshua. Next time you're outside and you hear a crow, take a moment to just look around and try to figure out where they are. I know almost every time that I'm outside and I hear a crow, I will make a little effort to try to let him or her know that I'm paying attention. And I'll sometimes you can tell that they're paying attention, but it's an exciting world. I think this concept of befriending animals and kind of working with them, animals that perhaps we've overlooked, it's a bit debatable whether or not we should learn to appreciate an animal like a crow, because finally we figured out how we can put it to use. But just as with dogs or cats or animals that we domesticate, I don't think most people like their dog simply because it makes a good watchdog or it fetches the newspaper. We form these relationships. So in the process of formulating new styles and forms of communication and relationships with the animals around us, assuming that we don't abuse them, we will all have a lot to share. And in the years ahead, I'm going to be introducing some ideas about a new way in which humans and animals can interact on this earth. But it's a little ahead of its time. So rather than set myself up for the abuse that would come from such a concept, I'll wait until later to tell you. Now I got your interest. So join us each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit as we reach out around the world to bring you the world's finest voices and minds about nature and the environment on the Weekly Earth Summit. Now stay tuned, because when we come back, I'm going to take a look at some of the stories that are making headlines in the realms of nature and the environment here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a complex world out there, and we keep learning more about ourselves and this planet every day. Coming up, we take a look at some of the stories making headlines in the realms of nature and the environment, and we continue our celebration of crows and their friends. Stay tuned. So now we take a look at a number of stories that are making headlines in the realms of nature and the environment. Feeling the pinch from the high price of gasoline these days? Well, the price of oil reached an all-time high again of $127 or more per barrel. This despite the fact that Saudi Arabia has pledged to add an additional 300,000 barrels to the global supplies. But it just really doesn't make all that much difference. Experts are beginning to talk about where this may go. And some analysts are predicting that $200 a barrel price is something we probably can look forward to. And, you know, the way this always works is those analysts, when it comes to the highest price, are typically right, and sometimes even a bit short of the mark. Investment bank Goldman Sachs is very much involved in setting the standard for futures mark. In March of 2005, they suggested that oil might pass $100 a barrel, and of course, they were right. On March 16th, they put a forecast out that they expect that oil will reach $141 a barrel by the second half of 2008, and that this $200 a barrel number could happen if there was some sort of a shortage. For example, if there were something that would affect the supply chain. The experts take a look at the causes for these things, and there's a variety of reasons that they're suggesting. They're saying that oil prices are still based on what they call the demand growth. That is the fact that the world supplies are limited, but the demand is increasing. There are some problems with the supply of oil. Production is flat in Russia. Russia is the second-ranked oil giant after Saudi Arabia. Civil unrest in Nigeria has knocked out about 1 million barrels a day. Iraq, which was supposed to be supplying us with tons of oil, still hasn't been brought back to even the pre-war production levels. Venezuela has been cutting back on its production, and Mexico is seeing a decline in finally their reserves. So these things certainly are affecting the price of a barrel of oil. At the same time, China and the Middle East are buying up oil reserves, and even this most recent earthquake in China is expected to increase the demand for oil as the reconstruction puts added demands on their power needs and the electrical grid. Add on this the fact that Japan has recently been closing some nuclear reactors, and therefore it's consuming an extra 200,000 barrels a day of oil. So the Saudi Arabian 300,000 barrel increase really isn't even meeting the new demands. But there's also some other factors, and one that people are taking into account, and this has to do with the commodities futures trading. There's an interesting factor that could play into this upcoming presidential election, and that is the fact that following the Enron scandal, there was a loophole put into the energy bill, which they now refer to as the Enron loophole, which removed regulation of electronic trading of oil futures by very large traders. Sort of counterproductive to what actually brought this on. What can happen is that large amounts of oil can be locked up offshore, putting away stockpiles that then escape direct scrutiny by U.S. regulators. And this kind of movement of large amounts of oil can really change the value of a barrel of oil. But getting to the point here, ultimately, there's a farm bill that passed the Senate last week by a veto-proof margin. Includes a provision to close the loophole, the Enron loophole, and bring greater record-keeping and scrutiny to electronic trading of the oil futures. Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton want the loophole closed, whereas a top advisor to GOP candidate John McCain said that the candidate has no position on the issue. However, this Enron loophole came to be at the behest of Texas GOP Senator Phil Graham, who is now McCain's closest economic advisor. And his wife, Wendy, Graham's wife, Wendy, was once one of the top commodities regulators in the United States and also was a member of Enron's board of directors. So this issue of the Enron loophole is one to watch into the future as we go into the 2008 elections and is a very precise discriminator between the Democratic and Republican candidates. Venezuela, which is rich these days from the oil that they produce and the extraordinary increase in the cost of oil, is doing what a lot of people wish they could do. A lot of environmentalists would certainly say and have fought for years to do what Hugo Chavez is doing in Venezuela, and that is that they're literally shutting down a lot of their open-pit gold mines, and they're trying to preserve the vast stretches of the Imataca Forest Reserve. Venezuela has stopped all environmental permits for open-pit mine exploration for gold, something that many environmentalists here would certainly like to see. And as well, they're protecting large stretches of the Amazon rainforest, of which they own a lot, because they feel as if right now they really don't have to give up this resource. They're going to hold on to these things. Venezuela's environmental minister, Yuviri Ortega, said that for the moment we do not need to exploit these minerals. As the president says, we don't need diamonds or gold or coal. So therefore, they're going to leave them in the ground. Aren't they lucky? About the same time, by the way, we're hearing stories these days. You're hearing this more and more and more coming through the media. We have significant resources of oil and natural gas here in the United States to help us out towards energy independence. I even heard that there's enough oil readily available that could provide 5 years of energy for the United States. The trouble is it's in the form of oil shale. And I kind of think if we just basically took out the Rocky Mountains, we could have energy for 5 years. Now that's a deal. We hear all the time about the decline of animal species and some new reports coming out of England. The Worldwide Fund for Nature, the WWF, announced last week that the world biodiversity has declined by almost one-third in the past 35 years, due mainly to habitat loss and the wildlife trade. And it also indicated that climate change could add increasingly to the wildlife woes over the next three decades. Colin Butfield, who is the campaign head for the WWF, said, "Biodiversity underpins the health of the planet and has a direct impact on all our lives. So it is alarming that despite an increased awareness of environmental issues, we continue to see a downward trend." WWF's Living Planet Index tracks some 4,000 species of birds, fish, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians globally. And it shows that between 1970 and 2007, land-based species fell by 25%, marine by 28%, and freshwater by 29%. Marine bird species also fell by 30% since the mid-1990s. Think about that. This gives credence to some speculation that we are perhaps at the start of the sixth great species wipeout in the Earth's history, the last which occurred about 130 million years ago. One of the things that concerns people the most is the fact that these species provide the vast bulk of the world's food and medicines, and therefore could have a true effect on the human species' survival into the future. Something's got to change. Well, it's been a long, hard fight, and an amazing one, that keeps on turning and twisting. But oil drilling in the Arctic may need to slow down now that polar bears have been protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. U.S. Interior Secretary Dick Kempthorne this past week added polar bears to the list of threatened animals due to the fact that the sea ice habitat is rapidly melting. And therefore, as a result of that, this protection, oil industry and natural gas exploration, particularly in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, will become much more difficult in the years ahead. The Bureau of Land Management proposed a 10-year leasing moratorium for 430 acres of wetlands north and east of the vast Teshikpuk Lake in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Environmentalists and local groups hailed the decision as a great success. "It's a win," said Stan Senner, executive director of the Audubon Alaska, one of the groups campaigning for the preservation. "I think they've responded to public interest in seeing that the area is protected, and it gives people who care about the place time to work on a permanent solution." We've been following this story ever since the beginning of the Wild Side News, and it's gone this way and that way, and at this point, this perhaps may have sealed the deal up there for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Here's a great story. Great story of success. There's some really ingenious ways that are being proposed to counter the global warming and the concentration of CO2 gases. One of those that was proposed by UN Environmental Program, UNEP, they began a drive in 2006 to plant a billion trees by the end of 2007. And they announced that by the end of 2007, 2 billion trees had been planted. Twice as many as they'd hoped for. And as a result of that, they've now set a new campaign goal of having 7 billion trees planted by late 2009. That means that there would be one tree planted for every human on the planet. What a concept. It's amazing they think they're going to be able to do it. One of the interesting aspects of this story is the fact that regional and national governments organize the most massive plantings. Ethiopia led the way by planting 700 million trees. Isn't that wonderful? And in Turkey, they planted 400 million. Mexico, 250 million trees. And Kenya, 100 million. One UN official said that 7 billion trees would, as they grow, soak up roughly the same amount of carbon dioxide emitted by Russia in a year. Russia, being the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases behind the United States and Canada, that's making a difference. And here's a follow-on story to that. This issue of climate change, everyone has made the point that it's extremely complex, and that the efforts that we're making may or may not succeed. But it's kind of interesting how nature has a way of working its own angles on this. One of the things that's happening right now is that in Sweden, they're noticing that mountains are becoming much greener. At the areas that border between woods and the Bear Mountain, trees that require warm temperatures like oak and elm and maple and black alder have become established in those areas for the first time in 8,000 years. Larger green life is expanding and growing and enriching as a result of global warming, which is one of the upsides. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there may be two sides to this story, or three or four, or perhaps 1,000 different sides to this story. Over the last century, the temperature has risen by 1 degree, which has broken a cooling trend over the last 7,000 years, which has triggered the changes in flora and fauna and the landscapes. Most noticeable is that along the melting of the glaciers is an elevating of the timberline by 200 meters. Bare alpine areas are shrinking. And typical Nordic mountain birch forests are losing ground to spruce and pine, which are more competitive in a warmer and drier climate. The alpine landscape is becoming generally greener and more inviting. Many mountain plants have produced profuse blossoms as well as prodigious amounts of seeds and fruits in the last few years. Plants that were previously limited to the borderline between woods and Bear Mountain are now rapidly climbing the alpine slopes. The changes are so rapid that plants like fireweed have even taken root in the gravel up on the melting glaciers. It's amazing that once life is given a chance to happen, particularly if it's given enough water and warmth, it explodes. That's a story that needs to be investigated even more in the years ahead. There's a sad trend happening out in the open ranges. It seems that because of the cost of almost everything going up these days, but in particular feed and gas for trucks, horses are now being literally set loose into the open west because ranchers and farmers just really can't afford to take care of them anymore. And it used to be sort of a badge of honor for an old horse to be set free, but unfortunately that doesn't work well for these older creatures, because they have no natural instinct on how to survive or the plants that they need or the dangers that are there. There's a massive increase of horses being let loose, and unfortunately, they're probably going to die out there. One of the contributing factors to this is the fact that pressures from the Humane Society and animal rights advocates, horse slaughterhouses were essentially banned in the United States. And therefore, it's very difficult to know what to do with these horses. At this time, if you want to dispose of a horse, let's say an old horse that's somewhat terminal or just very old, you have to truck them down to Mexico or up to Canada. So because the cost of that is so difficult, and as well, that type of a long journey can be so rough on these horses, a lot of ranchers have just determined they're going at night and releasing their horses into the wilds. There's so many angles to these factors, these interrelated economic and environmental factors, this being a unique story that is just truly a sign of the times. Now, if my bird Smokey is listening, I've got some great news for you. Researchers in London, bird lovers, there's a lot of bird lovers there, have announced that birds really deserve and actually benefit from eating human food. It's, you know, scraps from the table, as opposed to just grains. They actually thrive on certain types of food. For example, grated cheese or oatmeal or apples, bananas, and strawberries. Birds love crunchy things, biscuit crumbs and potato skins. My bird loves cooked rice and various breakfast cereals and pastry. And the point of all of this that they're trying to make is that feeding birds bread is not a good thing to do for them, particularly this time of the year when they're raising young and they're laying eggs and different things require a lot of energy, because bread really doesn't provide them with the nutrients they need to carry on their very energized lifestyles. So the point is, go ahead, and as long as it's not too sugary or too fat, share some of your treats with your bird. The thing about birds is they don't require a lot of food to survive, so there's always, it wouldn't be difficult for me to leave a few scraps on my plate and make my bird a very happy little creature. So, Smokey, things are looking up. Those are some stories that caught my attention this last week in the realms of nature and the environment. And now, following on our theme of our fascination with crows, I'm going to take time to read a story that I wrote from a real-life experience a while back, The Squirrels. But if you listen carefully, you'll understand why I give this in tribute to the crows as well. It's been a long time since I've had the chance to hang out with squirrels. I grew up in the Midwest where squirrels were residents. Even as a child, it was obvious that squirrels had complex habits. They seemed busy much of the time with food, finding it, burying it, unburying it. There were the somewhat regular disputes, with squirrels racing like electrons up and around trees, chasing one another, tree bark on the old elms bearing their clawed pursuit, sounding like metallic rain. Most often it was merely a chase, but sometimes things got serious, squirrels locked in a scuffling ball of frenzy, spewing dirt and dust and grasses in a wake of rage. And then there were the stiff bodies in the alleys and streets, for squirrels seemed almost drawn to running under moving cars. I understand squirrels. I appreciate their passion. They are prominent neighbors. But I had been away from squirrels, living in the high desert of New Mexico for so long. So it came as a pleasant surprise to find myself camped next to a family of squirrels at Dos Picos County Park, just outside Ramona, outside of San Diego, California. I ventured there on a Tuesday in May, so the campground had only a handful of campers. I'd set up my tent, organized my provisions and gear, which had been hastily thrown into the back of my truck, and finally took my first real sit on the wooden picnic table. The scrub oaks, which sheltered the campground in their umbrella of reaching limbs, created a near mystical setting. One feels the transition from the urban to the wild slowly emerge from within, like the warmth that spreads from the first sip on some good scotch. The settling, the grounding, the expanding awareness out and away from the sense of me, and a sizzling quietness rebirths. One finds a new way of looking. One sips and savors the surroundings. It took only a few minutes until I began to notice the squirrels. They are wary of all new beings and watch carefully from their sentry stance, erect, paws up, their large dark eyes absorbing the world around them. I quickly connect with the large dark eyes, and squirrels resume their gathering and peeking out from their burrows. There are 3 adult squirrels and 6 young squirrels in training. There are rules, lots of rules, to being squirrels. And the adults administer like schoolmarms and disciplinarians. Too far from the burrow, a squirrel chirp warns, "Stop, don't go any farther." There is also the loving side of squirrels. The adults seem always respectful of one another. They take turns at sentry, for which there is always one standing watch. They groom and nuzzle. The young play. Touch is important. The family has a bunker, a headquarters, which is a circular concrete fire ring, under which the squirrels maintain a series of entries. These connect in a mysterious way with 2 outlier posts, each about 20 feet away. The squirrels, at any one time, can be in 1, 2, or all 3 of these retreats, but always there is a sentry posted, watching. I'd forgotten squirrels, how present they can be. Along with the squirrels, there was an ongoing troop of large black crows. The crows seem in constant contact with this place. They have a different approach to life than squirrels. They seem mostly to focus on interacting with everything around them, mostly other crows, but also with the smaller birds, the acorn woodpeckers, and bluebirds, and jays, and nuthatches. They find food as it presents itself. They are prominent neighbors, too. At times, the worlds of crow and squirrel meet. I watched as an adult squirrel had wandered a considerable distance from its eastern bunker, doing its weightless leapfrog jumps through the grasses around its home, a squirrel's signature movement. 2 crows swaggered through the grasses as well, maintaining a 2-foot distance between them. The squirrel and the crows, when I noticed them, were about 7 feet apart, but moving towards each other. Neither side gave ground, and the distance narrowed. The squirrel seemed almost to want to confront the crows, and hopped right into the path of one of the crows, confident of its right to do so. And the crow waddled forward. They collided, as animals of different species sometimes do, and the squirrel went low, chirped a series of scolds, and battled the crow's leg. The crow made a quick flicking dance into the air, up, over, and beyond the squirrel. It seemed as if they had done this many times before. No tempers raised. It seemed a game. Animals, particularly squirrels, know the lay of the land around them. One squirrel ventured far away from the eastern bunker, actually going down into a shallow gully, then back up the other side and onto the asphalt pad where the truck was parked. 30 or 40 feet lay between the squirrel and the nearest bunker. It walked with assurance across the pad and on over to the water pipe, which emerged from the ground, upon which was my campsite faucet. It moved in close to the base and almost hugged the 4x4 post which supported the pipe. Its head turned, and it burrowed its mouth into the crevasse between the pipe and the post. There, a seminal source of water, just slow drips, gave this family a steady source. This family had chosen wisely to excavate their residence near this spot. I slept the night in my tent and found the new morning full of fresh wonder. The squirrels, too, exhibited a renewed vigor. The day was rich again, balmy as San Diego is. By afternoon, all eyes and vigor relaxed a bit. At one time, two adults perched on the concrete bunker, while the six young stretched full out, bellies flat to the concrete and hind legs stretched out behind them. They all seemed of one mind, to sun and relax. But on the western bunker, the other adult stood sentry, watching. I noticed how I too felt a little sleepy, and did lie down for a short while in the tent, that divine rest under oak trees, and the kiss of a perfect day with a gentle sun and easy dancing winds. I got out of the tent, still a little groggy, and went to the picnic table and sat. My eyes were still a little droopy. I'd noticed a counterpoint to this moment, some squawking in the ambiance, when the fast swoop of crow's wings and calls and screams erupted. I looked towards the source of the sudden splash of anxiety which centered on the western bunker. I saw the sentry there, only lighter in color, larger, and fending off the flybys of the screaming crows. It was a hawk, grounded at the burrow. I looked as the two squirrels rasped their fear-streaked screams at the horror, as the hawk held fast to the convulsed body of an adult squirrel. The local crows flew sorties at the hawk, which seemed to slouch its head and remain. I called out, "No, no, oh, I'm sorry," to my squirrel friends. I wanted to pick up a rock and throw it at the hawk, but knew I was witnessing a sacred, if terrible, event. But as the hawk just sat on the burrow with the squirrel, I thought perhaps if I walked towards the hawk it might let go of its prey, and perhaps the squirrel would only be wounded. And I felt I owed it to my dear squirrel friends who had accepted me as their neighbor in residence. So I walked down the little grassy gully and back up, retracing the route the squirrel had walked to the water spigot. The hawk knew what I wanted. It slouched its head again, its body tightened, and it lifted into the air. The sagging body of my squirrel friend, bushy tail trailing out under the overhanging canopy of oak, until it found an opening and then it disappeared, the crows giving noble chase to no avail. The six young were deep in their burrows. Two squirrels remained. The elder one was transfixed in a skewed upright stance, while the younger squirrel, who I felt was the female, cried out, once each second, towards its stolen friend. The scolding continued, second by second, for many minutes. By the time it ended, I'd clocked over 20 minutes. Towards the end, the sharp reproach changed, and a rasp appeared interwoven with the scold, and the rasp wilted to a hopeless breathlessness which eventually led to the end of the calling. Small dark eyes appeared from the burrows, barely breaking past the surface. The young poked their heads out. One actually climbed onto the concrete bunker, but not for long. My time had come to pick up my gear and put it back into the truck. I'd traveled light, so it didn't take long. All the time, I felt the flush of the wild within me renewed. Within 45 minutes, I was back home in Solana Beach, a day and night in the county of San Diego. I vowed I needed more. I appreciated this place for all that it had to give to me. Get out, say hello, greet the crows, open your eyes, have a great week. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet next Tuesday here, live, or on the archives anytime, when your voice of the earth calls out around the world, here on the Wild Side News. Thank you.